Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Chemistry World Podcast with editor Mark Peplow.
Hello.
Science correspondent Richard Van Norden.
Hello.
And Victoria Gill.
Hello.
I'm Chris Smith. This month, what's the future for generic drugs in India?
Médecins Sans Frontières are conducting a campaign to basically make Novartis back off. They say that this case will set a precedent that will threaten the ability of companies in India to make cheaper copies of drugs that are available to poorer patients.
We'll be talking with both players in that battle shortly. Also, a new breakthrough in imaging.
This is what they're calling the ultimate microscope. You don't need a lens at all to take very high-resolution pictures with X-rays, and it could be used to take pictures of living biological cells.
And an ultra-thin membrane that could hold the key to replacement kidneys.
Essentially, this is just a sieve for molecules. It's made out of a very, very thin layer of silicon, the stuff that they make computer chips out of. It's about 10,000 times thinner than a piece of office paper.
More from Mark with that story later. Also, a special hello to members of ChemNet, which is the Royal Society of Chemistry's network for A-level students. This month, you can win some HMV vouchers. All you have to do is to send us a review of this, the Chemistry World podcast. All the details of that and how to win it are in the March ChemNet newsletter. First, though, if you listened to last month's Chemistry World podcast, you'll recall Sarah's quest for a constipation cure.
As a doctor, I've been wondering why it is that magnesium compounds, like magnesium citrate and magnesium sulfate, are such effective laxatives.
Well, thankfully, Sarah, relief's on its way to you. We've got the answer coming up later in the programme. First, though, to the mind-bending chemistry of LSD, because researchers have sussed out how it triggers trips, Victoria.
Yeah, indeed. Some researchers at Mount Sinai University in the States have looked into what the secret is of LSD, what its hallucinogenic secret is. LSD works on a serotonin receptor called 5-HT2A. Now, it and other hallucinogens act on this receptor, but so do non-hallucinogenic molecules. They act on the same receptor. So the question they wanted to answer was, why are compounds like LSD hallucinogenic and other compounds that act on this same receptor not? So they did a number of tests. The first was with a knockout mouse, which had no 5-HT2A receptors. They gave that mouse hallucinogens, LSD, and found that it didn't produce an effect. So they confirmed that it was this receptor. Then they did some biochemical tests. And what the biochemical tests showed was that with another compound called lysuride, which acts on the same receptor but is a non-hallucinogenic compound, you get a different downstream group of chemicals produced in the cell, in cell cultures.
So they both work at the same receptor, but you get a different offshoot or different effect of stimulating the receptor.
Yes, exactly.
So how's that achieved?
Well, the 5-HT2A receptor is what's called a G-protein coupled receptor. And what they've discovered is that when the receptor's on the cell membrane and when the compound activates the receptor, it can switch it into two on phases. So it sort of switches the receptor into one shape for hallucinogenics and a different shape for non-hallucinogenics. So the receptor is still activated, but it activates a different chemical pathway in within the cell.
And that explains why you get these additional effects when the LSD is present.
Yes, exactly. So that's why it's hallucinogenic. You need the receptor to be in a specific on position in order to get hallucinogenic effects.
Thanks, Victoria. Well, from one toxic substance to another. And it turns out that canny snakes are stealing toads' toxins, Mark.
That's right. Most animals tend to steer well clear of poisonous toads. But scientists have found a species of Japanese snake which actually seeks them out and eats them. And they found that what it's doing is actually seeking out the poisonous toads so that it can steal their poison and then use it to hunt its own prey.
The obvious question, though, Mark, is why don't the snakes succumb to the toxin in the first place?
Well, this is one of the things that they've been investigating. And through looking at the chemistry of the toxins that they're taking in, they've come up with a couple of theories to explain how this might work. Basically, what they found is that the poison molecules in the snake are actually slightly different from those in the toad. And what they think is happening is that the snake is somehow chemically modifying these molecules so that it makes it safe to store, but it's still an active poison when it goes and hunts its prey.
Do we know how the snake then redeploys the poison, gets it from the right place in the body to where it needs it, i.e. in its venom glands?
They haven't looked at that at all. Really, the point of this study was to, first of all, establish that the snake definitely was taking up the toad's toxin. The way that they did that, actually, was to look at populations of these snakes, which are called Japanese colubrid snakes, on two different islands around Japan. One of the islands has loads of these toxic toads hopping around, and the other one has none. And they found that the snakes on the island with all the toads tended to have this poison in their system and were poisonous snakes, whereas the snakes on the toad-free island weren't poisonous at all.
And if you swap them round?
And if you swap them round, they took the snakes that had not had any toads in their diet ever and they fed them little toxic toads and they became poisonous snakes.
Thus proving it's got to be something in the diet rather than...
Absolutely. So they've proved that this stuff is coming from their diets. They've proved that it's coming from the toads. And although you do see this sort of relationship in certain insects, eating other insects or eating plants to get their toxins, there's a tree frog, for example, that eats insects specifically so that it can get toxins. It's very unusual to see vertebrates like snakes eating other vertebrates like toads to get these poisons.
Thanks, Mark. Well, back to drugs now, and an international furore that's raging between Novartis and the Indian government.
Yeah, what's happening is Novartis, the Swiss drug company Novartis, make a drug called Gleevec, which is a cancer drug. They've tried to get this drug patented in India, and the Indian government have refused. And Novartis are now saying that since India in 2005 should have become compliant with the World Trade Organization rules on patentable drugs, they're breaking the law. So Novartis are taking the Indian government to court.
Well, they are breaking the law, aren't they?
Well, it's a bit of a tricky area. What the Indian government claim is that Novartis are trying to evergreen this drug, trying to extend the length of time that they have a patent on it. They already have a patent on the original compound that the Gleevec is based on. Novartis claimed that this is a new breakthrough drug. The Indian government claimed, no, it's a compound that you already have a patent on with a minor change, so it doesn't count as new intellectual property.
What do people think about this? Do they think this is a reasonable thing? Do they think that Novartis have a case?
That's where the controversy comes in. The organisation Médecins Sans Frontières, who are a voluntary organisation of medical workers who work a lot in India and in the developing world, are conducting a campaign to basically make Novartis back off. They say that they depend on generic drugs and that this case will set a precedent that will threaten the ability of companies in India to make generic drugs, cheaper copies of drugs that are available to poorer patients.
Thanks, Victoria. Well, to find out more, I linked up with representatives of both MSF and Novartis to get their sides of the story.
I'm Pierre Chirac, and I'm working with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Novartis is challenging a decision by the Indian Patent Office regarding their anti-cancer drug Gleevec. And more importantly, they are challenging a crucial point of the Indian patent law. This is why MSF and others are worried by this trial. And we are asking Novartis to drop the case. But I think it's important to give some details on the Gleevec case. Imatinib freebase and its various salts, which is the active ingredient of Gleevec, was patented since 1993, 1994 in Europe and the US. At this time, India had no international obligations regarding patents. So in fact, there is no ground to ask India to consider the 1993 patent on Gleevec. Since India joined the WTO, World Trade Organization, this country has to comply with the World Trade Agreements dealing with intellectual property. Then Novartis have asked India to recognize another patent on Gleevec in 1998. India rejected this patent after a fair trial where chemical experts have proven that the particular crystal covered by the 1998 patent was in fact already covered by the 1993 patent. So the Indian Patent Office concluded that the 1998 patent could not be granted because of lack of novelty.
Let's just take this opportunity to bring in Petra Laux, who's from Novartis. Petra, how do you respond to the points that Pierre Chirac has made?
First, it's very important to understand that Gleevec is a real breakthrough treatment against a rare form of cancer disease, which is called chronic myeloid leukemia. And it makes sure that 95% of people who take the medicine, they still live 5 years after they have started treatment. So it's a worldwide recognised treatment.
But I don't think Pierre's arguing about that, is he? The potency of Gleevec isn't under scrutiny. It's actually whether or not India should be allowed to make it without having to pay Novartis lots of money.
To make it clear, we don't ask the 1993 patent to be recognised. However, patent that covers the active ingredient is not a medicine as such. It is the active ingredient which can never be tried in humans. So we did more work on this molecule. We invented the form that is actually applicable into humans. So we have been asking for exactly the form that is part of the medicine to be patented.
So, Pierre, it seems to be a valid point that Petra makes, which is that actually the medicine has been refined since the 1993 patent was laid down. 1998, they repatented this new formulation. Why shouldn't India respect that?
I would like to make 2 points. First one is that chemical experts during this trial said that, in fact, the most stable form of imatinib mesylate, which is covered by the 1998 patent, is already covered by the 1993 patent. The second point is that the certificate extending the patent term of Gleevec issued by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2004 is a 1993 patent.
Petra, what does actually the failure of India to recognise your patent mean to Novartis, and not just to Novartis, but other companies like Novartis? What could it mean to you financially?
Well, 3D is saying that you can only get a patent for a improvement of an existing compound if it's to be shown that the compound is better. Now, there's a substantial problem with this because at the time when we file for patent application, there is no medicine available. We have nothing but a compound that we then use to make a medicine. So by the way the Indian patent law is phrased, companies have no chance with clinical trials and efficacy data to really show that the improvements they are going for are better, which means in essence that there is no reliability because nobody can prove that their patent granted important patents for improvements. And it's not only about salts. Imagine India is a place where you have a very hot climate and many Indians also have diabetes. If there were to be a heat-stable insulin, which you would not need to put into the fridge, what an improvement this would be in India. However, a heat-stable insulin would not be covered by the Crisis 3D patent law because it was an improvement of a known compound.
Sounds to me, Pierre Chirac, like the Indian government could be shooting itself in the foot because big companies like Novartis would actually find it very unattractive to do anything beneficial for India if they're put over a barrel like this.
In fact, the section in the Indian patent law that Novartis is challenging is saying that, I'm quoting, salts, ether, polymorphs, metabolites, pure form, particle size, isomers, mixtures of isomers, complexes, combinations and other derivative of non-substances shall be considered to be the same substance unless they differ significantly in properties with regard to efficacy. This definition has been pasted word for word from the European Directive 2004 that is giving the new definition of generics in Europe, and the meaning of these two definitions in India is to avoid pharmaceutical industry to evergreen their patent in patenting mere differences in substances. We should remember that patents are supposed to be incentive for real innovation, not for cosmetic changes in substances.
And Petra Loeks, how would you respond to that, that you're just trying to evergreen your patents?
Well, the provision you quote, Pierre, is well ingrained in European legislation, but it is in the data exclusivity provisions and not in the patenting provisions, and that's a fundamentally different point. Novartis is very much convinced that all the improvements we are working for are supposed to deliver more value for patients, and so we are very confident that if we had a chance to prove it would be improvement in efficacy or more safety, we would be able to adjust that due to the construct in this Indian legislation where this concept has been taken from a regulatory concept into a patent environment makes no sense. There's another very important point to look at. I understand that MSF is very much concerned about access to essential medicines. Now, if it were true that we were just out there to get patents for stuff that is not worth it. So if these things were not available to patients, why would this make any difference for you? Because by definition, you are saying the stuff is not worth any patent. So why do you need it then to treat the patients?
I suspect that's a story that we'll be returning to in future. Thank you to Pierre Chirac from MSF and Petra Lauwers from Novartis. And now let's focus on how scientists are looking to build microscopes that promise to see better, brighter, faster and further than ever before, Richard.
Yes, Chris, this is what they're calling the ultimate microscope, which means a microscope where the wavelength that you can see is limited only by the wavelength of your incoming light. Now, with normal, you know, optical light, that's fine. We use a lens, very good lenses, to focus the light, and we can get down roughly to the wavelength of the light that comes in. With X-rays and with electrons, it's much harder to focus those type of beams. So the images are really about 100 times more blurred than you might think technically possible if you could focus them perfectly. But a new technique introduced by John Rodenberg and colleagues suggests that you don't need a lens at all to take very high-resolution pictures with X-rays, and it could be used to take pictures of living biological cells.
So how on earth do you actually gather the light data if you haven't got a lens?
Yeah, well, you don't need a lens. You can actually diffract light through an object and out the other side, and the way it scatters tells you what the structure was. Now, some people might be saying, well, come on, they did this in the 1950s when they worked out what the structure of DNA was.
It's called X-ray crystallography, isn't it?
Exactly. But X-ray crystallography, because it's on a crystal where the atoms have a regular structure, and it's quite a well-established field to work out what the crystal structure was from the way the rays were diffracted. But when atoms are not arranged in a regular shape, there's no regular structure, it's much harder to work out what the atomic structure was.
So like a living cell or something?
Yeah, something like a living cell. And what Rodenberg's team have done is essentially they've got a lot of fiddly computers and maths. And as the rays pass through the structure, they interfere with each other after they pass through. And by taking a series of overlapping diffraction patterns, so from overlapping areas of space past the object that you're looking at, you can work out how they must have interfered with each other and actually work backwards from that to tell you what the structure was.
So how long does it take to acquire an image then? And if you're looking at living things, because I could think one reason this would be really powerful would be to, say, look at living cells. If it takes too long, won't the structures inside the cell potentially have moved and therefore blur the image?
Yes, I don't know how long it takes to acquire them because they've not tried on living cells yet, but I believe it's a matter of hours. And the crucial advantage over other diffraction techniques is that you don't need a vacuum. You don't need to focus on a very small, isolated part of the sample. The way the overlapping diffraction patterns at the end work is that you can take a sample of any size or shape, which is a big advantage. So far, they haven't really got down to the cells. They haven't got down to the 0.1 nanometers that they say is theoretically possible. They've only shown a proof of principle demonstration that you can do this to around 50 nanometer resolution, which is still very good. But the principle is there, and it could go much further.
Thanks, Richard. Well, sticking with the very small, scientists have come up with an ultra-thin membrane peppered with tiny perforations, and this might hold the key to building a replacement kidney, Mark.
Yeah, essentially, this is just a sieve for molecules. It's made out of a very, very thin layer of silicon, the stuff that they make computer chips out of. It's about 10,000 times thinner than a piece of office paper, and it's got tiny little holes in it. Now, compared with the sorts of membranes that you normally see in dialysis machines, which are essentially just filtering your blood, they speed up the separation of proteins out of blood by at least an order of magnitude. Now, the holes in the nanocrystalline silicon are essentially just gaps left between tiny, tiny crystals of silicon. They're about 100,000 times smaller than the holes that you'd normally see in a kitchen sieve. And what they allow you to do, essentially, is to very quickly get small molecules filtered out of a liquid, leaving big chunky molecules like proteins behind.
Which is why we think they might have very great use as, say, dialysis membranes and things like that.
That's right. Normally, when someone's undergoing dialysis, it might take them 3 or 4 hours. What's essentially happening is that in the blood, you're leaving behind large protein molecules and filtering through very small waste molecules like urea, say, something that your kidneys do for you normally. Now, what the researchers who invented this membrane, who are based at Rochester University in New York, what they found was that they could achieve similar sorts of separations in about 6.5 minutes. To test this, they separated a really big chunky protein called bovine serum albumin from fluorescent dye, and they found that, yeah, you got complete separation in just over 6 minutes.
How do they make the membranes in the first place?
Well, they actually stumbled across a method to do this by chance. It's quite interesting. They were just trying to find out how silicon crystallises when it's sandwiched between two layers. And they found that because of the way that the crystals grow, it's almost like points growing up, and as they come together, they start to touch. And in between those almost circular crystals, you get these little holes appearing. And they found that by tweaking the conditions of that crystallisation, you can very precisely tailor the exact size of the hole so that you're filtering out exactly the size of molecule that you want.
So you could sort out bigger ones and smaller ones just by tailoring the way in which you grow these sheets?
That's right. They tried some different conditions, and they found that they were actually able to separate two different types of protein. So both big chunky molecules, one of them are slightly bigger than the other, and they actually managed to separate one 4 times as much as the other. Now, they think through optimising this, through tuning the conditions of the crystallisation just right, they can get the precise, perfect size hole that you can filter just about any biological molecule away from each other.
Thanks, Mark. And now to the slopes of the Alps, where it turns out that in order to make slushy snow more skiable, large amounts of ammonium nitrate, which is also a potent fertiliser, are being sprinkled on the snow. The downside is that, of course, when the snow melts, it all ends up on the ground and in watercourses. And Christian Rickson has been looking at the potential impacts.
Ammonium nitrate is being used on the snow surface to make it harder, to make it icy in case the snow is too warm. You can apply ammonium nitrate on the surface. That leads to a cooling of the snow surface to make it harder and to actually make a ski race happen.
So how do you know that ammonium nitrate's been added to the snow, and what are the possible consequences of that?
The use of ammonium nitrate can be common practice in some ski resorts during ski races to enable the ski race. What we are a little worried at the moment is during snowmelt, ammonium nitrate will run off in one large rush, and part of this will probably end up in the vegetation and the ground, and this could be a potential problem.
So which bits of the mountainside and where exactly have been affected by this?
The area we're talking about is at Lauberhorn in the Swiss mountains, where a famous ski race happens every year.
And is this practice allowed, or is this a covert practice that's just being done and isn't allowed, or is it something that should be regulated?
This is something that has to be found out at the moment, whether there are laws actually applying to this case, or whether this is an area that is not being covered by laws at the moment. This is being worked at the moment.
So in order to get it stopped, what's it going to take? Is it going to take you proving that sufficiently large doses of what amounts to very potent fertilizer are finding their way into waterways, or are we going to have to wait until something actually physically dies, until someone will do something?
First, we have to find out how much ammonium nitrate is actually used. Is this a very special case that happened now, or is it something we see regularly on ski slopes? The second question is how much is actually used, and how much of the ammonium nitrate used will end up in waters, and how much this is compared to what happens during fertilization in normal agricultural use. It's going to depend largely on that, whether there is a need for action or not.
Certainly a chilling thought. Christian Rickson, who's trying to find out what impact, if any, combating slushy snow with ammonium nitrate could have on alpine ecosystems. And now, sticking with the environment, are biofuels not all they're cracked up to be then, Richard?
Well, talking specifically about getting ethanol from corn, which the US really love, it sounds great. You reduce your dependence on foreign oil, you support your farmers, and you maybe reduce greenhouse gases. But scientists have been warning that actually ethanol from corn, not such a great idea. You don't reduce that many greenhouse gases. You don't get much of an energy benefit because you're putting so much into growing the crop in the first place, all your fertilizers, all your pesticides. When you take the whole life cycle of the corn into account, you're not getting much reduction in greenhouse gases and you're not getting much net energy gain.
But what about countries like Brazil? There has to be an argument made that getting ethanol from sugarcane there does make economic and also environmental sense because it grows in great profusion.
Yes. In fact, if you get ethanol from sugarcane, it's a much higher yield. And Brazil already has a very well thought out distribution process and, of course, a much smaller population. So although America's output, 5 billion gallons of ethanol last year, is about equal to Brazil's output, the two countries are not so similar at all. Nonetheless, in America, George Bush is pushing for 35 billion gallons of renewable fuels by 2017. So there's certainly quite a lot of biofuels to get there.
But you could argue that by encouraging people to embrace the biofuel movement, then you're much more likely to stimulate the field and, excuse the pun, the industry, and therefore you will see improvements which have environmental benefits in the long run.
Yes, in fact, there are close to 200, or going to be close to 200, ethanol plants set up in the US. And although I've just said that ethanol from corn might not be such a good idea, they are actually paving the way for a probably superior, what's called second-generation biofuels technology, where instead of getting ethanol from corn, which also, of course, impacts food supplies, you're actually getting it from the woody waste, corn stover, prairie grasses, the so-called cellulose and hemicellulose materials.
Is it easy to get energy from that? Is it going to be actually economically and energetically viable to try and do that?
Well, it's much harder to do that, very hard to break that down, but nonetheless some companies are attempting to do it commercially. And, you know, BP, Abengoa in Spain, they're all trying to get in on the act. And people Chemistry World talked to suggested that if government were prepared to put in subsidies and if entrepreneurs were to prepare to put in enough money and have a go at it, cellulosic ethanol technology could be commercially viable within the next 5 years.
So it's not just the states that are going for it. There are lots of countries around the world that are very interested in this.
Yeah, that's right. A European body has suggested that 25% of Europe's transport fuel could be or should be biofuels by 2030. So, you know, obviously Europe's really strong on trying to meet this target. And in all of these cases, it looks like cellulosic ethanol, not corn ethanol or wheat ethanol, not ethanol from food crops, is the way that people are looking to be going.
Thanks, Richard. And now back to this month's chemical conundrum from Sarah on why magnesium salts make such good laxatives. Well, we'll try and ease you into the answer very gently.
My name's Chris Lotz, and I'm Professor of Experimental Nephrology at the University of Birmingham. Magnesium sulfate and other magnesium salts are laxatives because they are what are called osmotic bulking agents. They're relatively poorly absorbed, so that when they're ingested, they stay in the gut lumen, and they osmotically attract water from the body fluids across the gut wall into the lumen. And this essentially has two effects. It makes the gut contents wetter, so that the stools tend to become moister and more easily passed. And also the very fact of activating stretch receptors because of the increased volume in the gut lumen promotes reflex peristalsis and filling of the rectum that also promotes the feeling of the wish to defecate. Magnesium salts are also very safe because magnesium is essentially non-toxic. It's a natural constituent of the body. It's present in the plasma. It's present in cells. It's present in the skeleton. And consequently, any magnesium that does get absorbed doesn't create any untoward effects, and it's very easily excreted by the kidneys. So all in all, it's a very safe agent to use.
I feel much better for knowing that. Thank you very much to Chris Lotz for that answer. And if that's left you with a bad taste in your mouth, what about potassium salts? Here's Sabina with this month's question.
Just wondering, could you tell me why is it that sodium chloride or table salt tastes so different to potassium salt?
So if you think you know the answer to that, please send us an email, chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you can also use that address if you want to send us any feedback about this programme. That's it for this month's edition, which was produced and presented by me, Chris Smith, from thenakedscientists.com, by Chemistry World's editor, Mark Peplow, and science correspondents Richard Van Norden and Victoria Gill. For more science news in the meantime, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. But until next month, goodbye!